Access number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Rail 14. Now, what about the first flight? Any problems with, as a result of this sort of 2 month gap?
No, absolutely no problem at all. I felt fit and totally in command of being able to fly the aeroplane. And I see in the logbook I flew for an hour and 10 minutes on a sector recce, which is merely official jargon for mooch around in the air just to find out what the countryside looked like. And Klagenfurt, of course, is surrounded by fairly high mountains, most picturesque, and I'd never flown amongst mountains before, so that was, you know, picturesque and original and something quite new.
And that was 9th of May.
And
what about any characters? I mean, you were a bit frozen out here. But any was Gordon Henderson the CO at this time, or
yes, Gordon Henderson was the CO.
Did he make you welcome? Or he seemed a cheery fellow.
Yes, but not over much. But he's certainly a very cheery fellow. But he interviewed me the day after I arrived. I had to go and report to him and with my logbook, which he looked at and was, I gather, not ever so impressed. And subsequently, he formed the opinion that Kievel had not been a very good place to fly, but that was due to some of the characters who followed me onto the squadron. He never actually said that about me or in my hearing.
And what impression did he make on you as your first squadron leader?
Well, I couldn't believe, really, that he was CO, because he looked so young. He was only 2 years older than me anyway. He had a DFC. When he was pointed out to me, when he was sitting at a table, for example, before I formally met him, I could barely believe that he was old enough to be the CO. But subsequently, by his general behaviour and attitude to everything, I developed a very definite, what I might always say, affection for him, because his whole character was infectious.
Everyone. In what way? People have said that. What was he like?
He was a very happy, pleasant, easy. Well, when you got to know him, which I did quite quickly, I suppose, easy to get on with person. Certainly not officious in any way, except when he had to be, when he had to exert some authority. He was always the first person to sort of enter into almost anything, a party or a drinking competition, or a telling joke session, or he was always amongst the first to be there. So he was a leader, if you like, and not necessarily a leader in the right direction, because then, I suppose, a little, but certainly much later, we got into the most terrific situations, which we wouldn't have got into had it not been for him and his very happy disposition. But he was not a CO of the normal type, and I don't think the more senior officers really approved of his conduct and demeanour, if you like. But after the first few days, if you like, when the ice became broken, and I got to know him and got to know some of the others.
Now, any other characters?
Well, yes. Kurt Tausig, of course, was there.
Now, he'd be a pilot officer or flying officer?
He's a flying officer. He might have been a flight lieutenant by then, but he certainly was, if you like, a junior officer. And there was Kurt Tausig.
Now, what was he like? I mean, you know I've met him, but what was he like then, as far as you were concerned? Because he was quite, not unusual in the RAF, because they had lots of people from other places. But
well, yes, he was the sort of person I don't think I'd ever... unlike any other person I had ever met before. I mean, he was a a Czechoslovakian. He obviously hadn't become British citizen then. He did that subsequently. But he was one of the few people on the squadron who could speak fluent German, so that he was the liaison between the staff, who domestic staff who ran the mess, if you like, and the caterer. He was in charge of catering in as much as he organised, because of his fluent German ability, he would be in charge of buying all the meat and the potatoes and all that sort of stuff for the whole unit, let alone the officers' mess. So as a result, we fed extremely well, even though food would have been fairly short immediately after the war in Austria. We had German prisoners of war, or they gave them some other name, displaced persons, I suppose they were, for the domestic staff, was supposedly a batman, which I hardly ever saw, and certainly people who waited at table were that calibre person, either ex-POW or a displaced person from some other European country, who was waiting for the authorities to organise their trips home, and they all worked quite happily because nobody was under any pressure. And so there was Kurt Tausig and there was Eric Pyle.
What was he like?
He was blonde, very affable, very friendly. I don't know how much operational time he'd had, but he'd had some, and he was, a competent chap to fly with, and I say fly with, I mean in another airplane. Several other people. Jeff Vaughan was another.
Jeff with a J or a G?
G. Jeff Vaughan was another chap I palled up with very quickly.
What was he like?
He was short and tubby, a very good soccer player, and came from Liverpool, had a slightly Liverpudlian accent. There was Pippler.
Pippler?
Yes, Pippler. I can't remember his Christian name. He was always known as Pip. But Pippler.
Flying officer.
Flying officer. And then my flight commander was... I've got his name in my logbook, because he would have been he would have signed my logbook. There was Jack Stonier, who was a very senior flight lieutenant, and Von somebody, I can't remember his surname. I'm looking for it.
How did the thaw come with it? I mean, they sort of ignored you.
Well, yes, they didn't so much ignore me, but didn't invite me to enter into anything. So I felt a bit frozen out, which very quickly broke down, and it broke down merely by being in the mess and standing at the bar and swapping a beer or two. The beer at lunchtime was free, because they organised it, that any mess bills they paid covered the small amount of drinking that took place at lunchtime. But since no flying was done in the afternoon, there was not much restriction on drinking beer at lunchtime. But I found very, very quickly, and the fact I'd learnt before that I cannot drink beer at lunchtime without it going to my head and making me feel disinclined to do anything very energetic in the afternoon. And a position which still applies, I might say. But because I couldn't resist the temptation of having a free beer, and neither would anybody who'd come out from straight out from England when you know, having a beer was still quite a luxury. I've quickly learnt to avoid drinking beer at lunchtime, made up for it perhaps in the evening. But I think mixing at the bar and the larking about that, that took place in the bar, in the mess, soon broke down any reserves.
Now, what about drinking habits? How much were they drinking? Was it a hard drinking? You know, there's a difference. Hard drinking is one man's not.
Yes.
You know.
To my knowledge, very few were hard drinkers. It was nearly all drinking beer, and by the half at that, it just was, you know, the standard thing was a half a beer.
So it certainly wasn't drinking whiskey and stronger stuff.
I hardly saw any, to my knowledge, anybody drinking the hard stuff. When we were in transit, on these awful train journeys and things, we sometimes had an issue of a voucher which gave you access to when you did reach a mess. The chitty voucher said 2 gins or 2 whiskies or something, and you handed that over probably with your payment, which was a negligible amount of money, but. So they rationed you fairly cleverly in transit, so nobody drank too much. But we soon got the hang of it, and I used to swap my whiskey vouchers for gin and settled for one or the other. And I found that I preferred gin to whiskey. It had less effect, I think, I thought, on my head. So I had a double amount of gin and topped it with somebody else who had a double amount of whiskey. But in the mess, there was very little spirits drunk.
And what was it like in the officers' mess? This is in this old building.
This lovely old building. Well, it was the only room I can remember. I suppose there must be showers and loos and so on the same floor. But there was this biggish room with two long, thin dining tables, at which the CO sat at the head of one of them, and the rest of us just ranged around lower down. But there was very little formality in the mess at all. It was just a friend. It set out to be a friendly, easy place to live in, spend one spare time in. I know that during the afternoons when I, you know, there was nothing going on and no flying going on, nothing to do, and I wasn't given anything to do. I used to go for quite longish walks up into the woods behind the mess, and there were miles and miles of wooded country and well marked paths, so you didn't have to hack across difficult terrain, but just pleasant walking. And so I used to get myself out of the way by going on to 2 or 3 hours walk and get back in time either for tea or for dinner at night.
Were there any formal mess dues?
I don't remember any at Klagenfurt at all. We weren't there terribly long.
I get that impression. Were just into June or...?
Well, I'm just looking. I suppose by July we had moved. May, June, July, that's 2 months later. We had moved from Klagenfurt down back to Italy.
And where'd you go to in Italy?
And we went, according to the logbook, we went to Tisano. But I'd forgotten that bit. We went to Tisano, where we shared the airfield there with a couple of other squadrons, and we had a wing commander or maybe even the group captain. There was a station commander there, and we did a certain amount of flying from there.
And what kind of flying? I mean, was it just flying for the sake of it, or did you have a role at all?
No, we had no role to play.
What about these keeping an eye on the Yugoslavs? Were you doing any of that there?
Well, that had all been done.
That's all finished.
That had all been done. That squadron had been very busy keeping an eye on the Yugoslavs and dropping supplies to the army, who were manning the outposts up in the mountains, and during bad weather they found it difficult to get rations and so on to these army chaps, and we used to drop. Apparently, the squadron used to drop supplies by parachute to them, and drop mail off to them and that sort of thing. So, but that's all finished by the time I got there, and unfortunately, so there was literally nothing to do except show the flag, and we did, I see from my logbook again, a lot of formation flying, and I did a certain amount of photography.
Now, what were you photography?
Well, it was purely an exercise again, and I see that I did 4 hours of oblique photographs, taking oblique photographs, which was the one from the side of the plane. As you remember, I told you that there was a mark on the canopy and a mark on the wing, and you just lined those two things up, and that was sighting the camera. And the army liaison officers, which we had three, a major and two captains, and they were with us all the time, even when we went down to Italy. They would cook up an exercise for us, taking a photograph of a road or a range of mountains or something like that, something so that you had to identify it from the map and find it and take the photograph along the lines of, as I've described, when we were at Kiewel. But I'd forgotten that I took some photographs there because I think it was either at Klagenfurt or soon afterwards then that our photographic section was disbanded. So we had the whole squadron had a big photographic section able to cope with the developing of these films. And the idea was that we took the photographs, went landed back at the airfield, and the cameras and their contents were rushed to the photographic unit, and there they were developed. And if it was for real, photographs would have been then rushed to the army liaison officers, and they would have interpreted them, and from that they would have recommended the next target or the next reconnaissance that would be required. So they used to liaise with the army. That's what they were called, after all. But we still carried on doing those things as an exercise.
But the photographic section was disbanded.
Well, at some stage, either at Klagenfurt or perhaps soon afterwards, it was disbanded. I'm not quite sure what happened first. Which happened first? Either the disbandment or the fact that the skilled photographers got released for demobilisation, and so there was nobody to run the section. That's how the whole system was run down after the war, by people being returned home, and the whole section just faded away. And the same could have been said for the armoury section, for example. There were no bombs, and certainly no bombs, and not necessary to arm the machine guns, so the whole armoury section disappeared. My disparaging remark about the surgeon who operated on me when I was at Kiewel was that he did such a bad job. I'm quite sure he was a remustered armourer and not a surgeon at all, I would have thought an ex-armourer could have done a better job on me than he did. Anyway, we've glossed over that. So bit by bit, the squadron specialities like photography and armaments and cipher, code and cipher was another section which just disappeared because there was no need, absolutely no need for it. And the only time I met the code and cipher officer was at the reunions subsequently. Anyway, let's get through this Klagenfurt business.
Well, you're at Tesano now.
Well, all right. In Tesano.
If there's more you want to say about Klagenfurt.
Well, Klagenfurt, we certainly did move from Klagenfurt back down to Tesano, but if you like, before we left, there were quite a number of abandoned German vehicles at Klagenfurt, a truck or two, and certainly a motorcycle and sidecar or two, because whenever a compass needed swinging on, in which case an aircraft had to be started up and taxied out to a spot well away from any metal on the airfield, and the compass was swung, and it required two or three people to move the aeroplane from through the various 360-degree circle so that the compass could be read at the north, south, east and west and so on, and adjusted accordingly. We used to pile into this motorcycle and sidecar and career around the airfield to this spot, and again having done the compass swinging, we would career back to the mess, and I told you it was up a 50 foot or so above the airfield level at Klagenfurt. And the great thing was to race this motorcycle and sidecar so fast that it would get up this 50 foot or so quite steep slope without toppling over, and all the shrieks and the screams and the laughs that used to go with that. But you know, that was the sort of irresponsible type of thing that junior officers got up to. But anyway, so we moved from Klagenfurt down to Tesano, and much the same thing happened there. We just did routine flying, and we weren't there very long, but the group captain in charge of the whole Tesano setup didn't get on very well with Gordon Henderson, or the other way around, and perhaps we didn't behave as quite as demurely as we should have done in the group captain's mess. So he organised that the whole squadron detached itself from Tesano, and we went to another airfield some 5 or 10 miles away, which was called Campo Formido. And we spent a much longer time in Campo Formido.
So when did you go there? Still in July or in June?
Well, again, it's not clear from my logbook because I didn't make a note of the actual movements, but certainly by August, September, I suppose we were.
So we said roughly August. We're not far away there. Well, either, you know, as a median point. Now, yes. Tell me about the setup at Campo Formido.
Well, Campo Formido we were in tents again at Campo Formido. I suppose we might have been at Tesano, but I can't remember. But certainly we were at Campo Formido because when we got there, there were no tents at all. There were just bundles of canvas and bits of stick and bits of rope and things. And so the tents had to be erected. And I suppose the airmen must have erected their own, and certainly the sergeants did. And we had to, if we wanted somewhere to sleep, we had to erect our own. And so we were allocated an area. Either the CO or the adjutant would have said, right, it'll be there. And it was right up alongside a field which was being cultivated by the Italians, in which they grew corn on the cob. They grew and they grew this crop for their animal feed. But they also fed us, incidentally, because we used to sneak over the no real boundary to sneak over. We had a bit of barbed wire, I suppose, to protect us in a small way, but it wasn't very difficult to get through or around. So we used to pinch corn from the cobs just over the fence. Not very often, but enough to supplement our diet. And so we had to erect these tents, which were quite decent tents with a fly sheet over the top. And there were two-man tents. We had a camp bed inside, and we made them into two-man tents. And I shared a tent that I can't remember even the name of the chap I shared the tent with, but we got on quite happily and were no bother to each other.
Where was the mess?
And the mess was in another slightly bigger tent, quite nearby, and so were the loos, also in a tent, which was a bit cold at night. Anyway, we were there in Camp of Formido for quite a long time.
Now, what do you remember of life there? Because I know quite a few of you think of that quite fondly.
Well, yes, we revelled in being on our own, away from the other squadrons and the formality of the group captain and his mess having to behave ourselves, so we could behave as we wished, or as was dictated by Gordon Henderson, really. I forgot to mention that while we were in Klagenfurt, Gordon Henderson got married, which was important.
Well, do you want to tell us about that? Well,
it doesn't really matter, but he did get married from the mess at Klagenfurt, and certainly the party afterwards was quite a considerable one, because he was so popular. A lot of people managed to find their way to Klagenfurt to join in the celebrations afterwards. But I remember he was still with us at Camp of Formido, having being married, but his wife had some sort of accommodation they were provided with, because every so often we would we were invited to go around to talk to Gordon and his wife Margaret. Flying was interesting. Again, a single runway. This wasn't a concrete runway. This was a pressed steel plating, PSP, laid by the army, and they were interlocking sheets of steel. And the sort of thing you see these days used to support the side of deeply excavated hole by the roadside or the building site, if it's used to steel shuttering, because it locks together, interlocks on the long side, so it kind of forms a fence or a mat, and in this case it was laid as a mat down on the natural earth or sand, and it gives a hard and well-defined surface for a runway. We had this both in Klagenfurt and in Italy. But except the fact that it makes a lot of noise when your wheels touch the ground, touch the steel, it's just like running on and off a piece of concrete. But so we had this PSP runway. And the great fun about it was later on when we were there, when it became snowy and frosty. When this steel plating gets frosted or a slight cover of snow, if you drive a jeep down it, you can do the most spectacular skids and I don't know what you call them to turn the whole vehicle around 360 degrees and more, if it continues in a straight line, and it's enormous fun, because you know you're the only vehicle on the place, you're not going to collide with anybody, and to do it when it's getting dark and it's just snowed turned out to be, if one was orderly officer, one certainly had a go at doing that quietly when nobody was looking. So we flew the usual sort of routines,